Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about sustained enjoyment after the age of 50 is linked to a longer life. University College London, and a study links nutrition to brain health and intelligence as you age. That's from the University of Illinois. And then sleep helps to process traumatic experiences, University of Zurich, and a lot more on health and healing. I'm going to spend a little more time than normal today on our environmental segment because I'm going to be sharing some insights from Dar Jamal about life on Earth is dying. Thousands of species cease to exist. Just to put this in perspective, every 24 hours, 200 species go extinct forever. And I was listening to a group of people in a gym where I was working out, and I was listening to them talk about body politics and things that are important. No one offered any suggestions of how to get these 103 million Americans back to work with a living wage and a quality of life and getting them out of debt and closing down the debtors' prisons, nor looking at the impact their lifestyles have upon the environment. So for all those who care around the world, what we can do, I'm going to share some insights. Also, I'm going to share a report on how the North Pole is melting and wildfires are raging across the United States, long past the burn season, well into winter. What is going to be coming up in the future? And I'm going to address one more time the idea that Hillary Clinton did not lose because the Russians hacked her emails. We have irrefutable proof of that, which means that the New York Times and the Washington Post and MSNBC and all the talking heads, the pundits, they're wrong. But I'm also going to show you how they're wrong on this, who says they're wrong on this, and why they're not looking at the truth. They're not looking at the record of false flag operations, the record of lies, deceptions, the fact that Hillary Clinton was the most hated, non-believable candidate who was an official candidate nominee in political history. They discard all that. They discard all of her subordinate of the truth. Well, we will share some of that with you. And about the truth, well, false stories seem to be what the mainstream and much of the alternative media shares with you. We'll point that out in detail, specific, historically accurate information. And my guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Craig Teft. Dr. Teft is a world-class athlete. He was the triple crown Mr. Natural bodybuilder. He was also on the medical staff of the U.S. Olympic team, and the U.S. National Swim Team, and the Race Across America group. So he's going to talk about how do we know we're getting enough of the right nutrients. I thought that would be important for people to know. Let's begin. It was way back when I was just a junior scientist, and I was looking at people one day in the laboratory, and these were all very respected scientists. They were all doing orthodox work, mainly in chemotherapy or drugs for pain. That was the specialty. Also drugs to get people off of methadone or heroin. I was considered the kind of the odd bird because I believed nutrition actually had something to do with health. And I would notice while there and talking with them throughout the day that none of them were healthy. They all smoked and drank. They were all overweight. And they all seemed to be extremely intense and driven. So I decided to take a trip around the world, and so over the next 5 years, I traveled to countries far and wide. I was interested in how is it that with all that we spend on healthcare, with all of our doctors and hospitals and medicines, that we're not living longer. In fact, we're at the dead last position in quality of health of all the industrialized nations. And I would look at people in the cities and the suburbs and then in the country. And the answer came to me because I saw people in the cities who had the same type of illnesses we see in people working in the cities in America. But the real answer came when I was looking in rural places, whether it was in Haiti, Dominican Republic, Cuba, which I visited, and also Dominican Republic, up to Haiti, Trinidad, Barbados, Venezuela, all these places, Brazil, all these places, seeing the difference of people who were working in the major cities, Brazil versus in the country, in Europe, etc. And when I came back, and after 5 years, on and off to different places, I finally came up with what I considered the formula that I've been using ever since. And here's how it works. On a scale of 0 being death and 100 being ideal health, I gave a percentage, which is flexible, about what if you could live an ideal life, if your diet was as perfect as it could be, and you drank the healthy, clean water, you had the juices, you took the right supplements, you ate the right foods in the right amounts, you exercised each day, you dealt with stresses that are always going to be with us, but you dealt with them in an appropriate manner. You didn't overact or act out. You weren't personalizing and over-emoting from everything. You put all that together, including the quality of the environment in which we live, and I came up with scores ranging from 15% to 20%, with stress, exercise, nutrition being just about equal. So if you did everything right, you were at about 55%. Okay, then why is it I was seeing people who were doing all that right, who were dying, were getting diseases? In fact, I was very fortunate. I was gifted with being a best-selling author on nutrition at a very young age, and hence I had a chance to meet, where otherwise I would have never had that opportunity, the older, more established, highly respected people like Adele Davis, Carlton Fredericks, Lior Cadell, Gaylord Houser, Linda Clark, Bob Hoffman, all these people. I met them, Betty Lee Morales, and I noticed something they all had in common. They were the people who were literally controlling the entire health movement, all the information coming out. I didn't find a single person, with the exception of Pavel Arola and Dr. Walker out in Arizona, none of them were healthy. And the reason they weren't healthy, I believe, is because they were very stressed. They never seemed happy. And I met them a lot. And then one day I just decided I just didn't want to be around these people, nor did I want anything to do with the health movement. And from that day till this, I've had nothing to do with the health movement in America. I don't go to the health conferences. I don't lecture at their fairs. I don't have anything to do with them. Quite simply because I don't believe there is a health movement. I believe there's an opportunist exploitation movement, but I don't believe there's anything representing health because I've never seen healthy people in this movement. I've never seen happy people in a spiritual movement or spiritual people in a spiritual movement. I just see all these contradictions and then the hypocrisy of it. What we want to believe, we overlook what is there. But what I found when I was dealing with people who were just living normal lives is the people who were living the longest life and the healthiest life were the happiest. So I began to realize the one nutrient we weren't aware of or using was happiness. And that's where I laid down the foundation that you really can't be healthy if you're not happy. And I've seen so many people believe otherwise. And they'll drink their wheatgrass and they'll rush through life and they end up with the same disease as anyone else. But they think they're getting healthy because of the things they're putting in. But it's what you don't put in that finishes the mirror of life. Those missing pieces are essential. And I've seen this in how people misrun radio stations, radio networks, don't have the right management, don't have the right programming, don't have the right attitude, and then wonder why you fail. Gee whiz, why don't we just have another meeting on it and have another bylaw or put another person not qualified for any of this in a position that requires qualification? And then you wonder why, with all the right ideas, did you fail? Well, hello, how could you not fail? It's like Huntington Harford, who had this MP fortune. It took him a long time. I knew him. It took a long time for him to burn through all of it, but in time he did, before he died. Well, a lot of people burn through opportunity, burn through gifts, and never once stop and say, is it me that's causing this, or circumstances or other people? It's very easy to point fingers, and that seems what people are, full-time finger pointers, blamers for what goes wrong in their life or their business. Instead of looking in the mirror, being honest, don't Photoshop your emotions, and simply look at the raw reality looking back. And more often than not, it's you. You're the reason that you're not happy. Now, you can blame through epigenetics, you can blame through conditioning, you can blame through circumstances, that it's not you. And that's fine. We live in denial, individual denial and collective denial. But what I saw all around the world was people not willing to live in denial. If they made a mistake, they owned it. They tried to learn from it. They didn't beat themselves up over it. It was just part of the process of growth. What did I do wrong? What lesson can I learn? How can I then not make that mistake in the future? Then you grow from these mistakes. So I found that people who were older everywhere in the world, everywhere I went, were healthier because they were happier. So now figure out what role happiness plays in your life. Now, if you're depressed, you're anxious, you're lonely, you're not happy. If you're sublimating your angst by being constantly busy, you're not happy. If you got to watch porn all day, you're certainly not happy. If you got to engage in the demagoguery that's apparent everywhere, you're not happy, because you'd be spending that quality time on yourself and the people you enjoy being with and things that are constructive and empowering. Demagoguery is all about disempowering people, blaming the other. And so when I counsel people, you would be surprised. I never just start off giving, oh, take this, eat this. No. I always start with every single person, no exceptions. Where do you place happiness as a percentage of your life effort? And then how can we get back to being happy, having something to live for, thinking positive thoughts, actualizing those thoughts, doing things that empower you in small ways? When I grew up, we had hobbies. Today, no one has a hobby. We had hobbies, and that empowered us. We had some moral discipline. That allowed us to understand real differences of, if you're not responsible for the choices you make that are wrong, then you're always going to be assuming that you're entitled to walk away from a mess you've created and let someone else clean it up. But if you do have, and or had, the parents, grandparents, teachers who gave you that sense of self, you're a better person today, and everyone in your life will feel that. That brings me to the University College of London. An article entitled Sustained Enjoyment in Older Age Linked to Longer Life. I'll quote this. Sustained enjoyment of life over several years in aging people is associated with lower death. And that study in the British Medical Journal shows that previous studies have shown that subjugation of our emotions to negative causes shorter lifespan, higher incidence of heart attack and stroke, and greater opportunity to overeat, to engage in self-destructive habits. But when you think about enjoyment, things that give you true satisfaction in life, and you shift your energy to that, then you don't have time for the negative. You're not spending all day angry and looking for someone to spit on. Because what do you do when you're rageful? You're spitting. You're spitting out hate using words, gestures, slogan. And it's not limited to any ethnicity. It's not limited to any age. But if you're happy, you are given a sense of fulfillment in life. Think of how much better you're going to be, because you're not going to be waking up blaming anyone. You're going to wake up and put something important in front of your mind and say, that's what I'm going to focus on today. And that's what this study shows. So there you have it. It's from way long ago when no one wanted to change. No one wanted to hear anything I had to say at the Institute and didn't. And they're all dead. And they weren't happy. But they were achieved. They were smart. They were credentialed. They were successful in different measure. But they were not happy. So what was the point of the whole exercise? So try to make happiness an important goal and watch health come right behind it. Because to be happy, you're going to be making better choices. And those better choices are going to be making choices about what sustains life, encourages health. And that means you're going to be plant-based, vegan, exercising, dealing with the stressful issues as information, not as little emotional minefields to overreact to. University of Illinois, a study links nutrition to brain health and intelligence as you age. And this was published in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience. They found that lutein is one of the several plant pigments that humans acquire through the diet and primarily by eating leafy vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, and like broccoli and important nutrients that get into our system. And they're saying that this good nutrition from our plants, and that would include juicing, those nutrients go to the brain. And once in the brain, that helps the brain heal from damage that might have been done earlier in life. Heavy metals, smoking, drinking, poor diet, chemicals in the environment. So that's very important. Quote, research also shows that lutein, that's L-U-T-E-I-N, accumulates in the gray matter of the brain region known to underlie the preservation of cognitive function in healthy brain aging, end quote. So here's the takeaway message. If you want to have a healthier brain, a brain that functions on your behalf longer, you have to feed it the right nutrients and stop feeding it what causes inflammation, which lays down that amyloid plaque that leads to dementia and Alzheimer's. It's that simple, not complicated. And sleep helps process traumatic experiences. This is the University of Zurich, and it says, if we sleep in the first 24 hours after a traumatic experience, this may help process and integrate the distressing memories more effectively. This is what researchers found. And that way you're better able to deal with them. So if you have a traumatic event, then make sure that you get to sleep. And before you go to sleep, write down what the traumatic event was, how did it happen, how did it make you feel, and what you need to do to deal with it. Put that down now that you've processed it in your mind, you've written it out, then get a good night's sleep. And that sleep will help process traumatic experiences so you're able to rid them. You process it, you get rid of it, you go on. If not, then that traumatic experience can keep recording itself over and over and over again, and that's not healthy for anyone. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Oh, one last thing. For women in particular, if you are an overweight woman, according to this university in Poland, the omega-3 fatty acids can help turn off chronic low-grade infections. That's important. And this was published in Molecular and Cell Biology of Lipids. So look at the omega-3 fatty acids. You can get them from vegan sources like avocado, walnuts, flaxseed, or you can get them from fish, or you can get them if you ate sardines. Of all the fish in the water, if you're going to eat fish, the sardine is the healthiest, because it has the lowest concentration of pollutants, very high level of the omega-3 fatty acids. And that can help turn off low-grade inflammation. And that's important. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City. You can watch any of our programs by going to Ustream channel and just looking for Gary Knoll. Also, if you'd like to listen to this program by a portable listening device, cell phone, regular telephone, live Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, just call 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. But believe it or not, 99% of the people who listen to this program over the internet at night, generally between 7 and midnight, they listen to the archive of the show. That archival number is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Now, tomorrow at noon, on all of our stations that carry this program, we're going to be broadcasting a very unusual interview. And this is an interview for all the people throughout Europe and around the world who listen and want to hear some deeper explanations of the crisis in the United States, and using a country, and we use Greece as the country. And if you remember Yanis, Varoufakis, who was the finance prime minister of Greece, he'll be on for an hour. And we're going to talk about how it is that the United States is running an 1,100% debt to gross domestic product, how we lie, fake news, saying that we have 4.7% unemployment when it's actually the lowest figure. Accurate figure I could get is 22%, but if you include those who are not working but did work but want to work but they've been excluded, it's 44%. 44% unemployment rate. You could imagine what that would do if we had to be honest. So we put in fake news, and everyone contributes that fake news, the administration that gives it and the media that doesn't challenge it. But when it came to Greece, did you know that 91% of all the money that they get in loans has to go back to the person giving the loan? They only get 9%. Well, how can you possibly pay back a loan at 100% plus interest if you're only getting 9%? That's the game. He'll be asked all these. So we're going to look at this as a template, because it's my opinion that Greece has been intentionally and with malice aforethought by the European Union, European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other bankers in the United States on Wall Street, like Goldman Sachs. They've been targeted as an example of not to get out of line by virtually bankrupting the country, putting its entire citizenry into debt servitude, stripping off its assets, its airports, its seaports, its roads, privatizing them, knowing that they can never possibly pay back the debt. So you hear me offering suggestions of what, good suggestions, I believe, of what they can do to get out of the euro, to let go of the eurozone connection, go through a painful period of probably up to a year, and then rebuild with a whole new set of trading partners, no debt, and let the European Union eat the debt and the greedy bankers. Let them have that. So in any case, that's tomorrow, the whole hour at noon. You won't want to miss that. Now to our environmental segment. Life on Earth is dying. I don't state that to frighten people. I state it as a matter of fact. Every 24 hours, and as you're hearing me right now, we're losing 200 species of life on Earth, plants, birds, animals, fish, amphibians, insects, reptiles. And tomorrow we'll lose another 200 species. Now you might think, well, I don't know about all these species. They couldn't be that important. Well, how about giraffes are now going extinct? Gorillas, orangutans. Why orangutans? Because we've been tearing down all their forests, burning their forests, in order to put palm oil plants in their place. It's rapacious, but it's being done. So do we have any responsibility for the destruction of our environment? The average person will say no. If I asked you, would you go without a cell phone because some of the, like cobalt and some of the other minerals used, are exploiting people, causing enormous hardship, and destroying the planet in those areas, polluting the water? But it's for your cell phone. Most people say, I want my cell phone. Okay, then you're willing to overlook all that. Are you willing not to buy a dress made in Bangladesh, where women get 14 cents an hour? Are you willing to insist that you only buy fair trade and fair labor garments? If you do, that's good. But if you don't care, then people will suffer. So when it comes to how much are we willing to change, the answer is we're not, for at least 90 to 95% of the population. Why am I not discouraged? Because with the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the Back to the Earth movement, the human rights movement, the anti-war movement, with 1% or less of the population actively engaged, we were able to turn the tide. So you do not have to have a majority to support a cause, for that cause to succeed. You have to have an enlightened, educated, empowered minority. So we have that. In fact, we have more than what you might expect. We have right now, I'm guesstimating, about 18 million Americans who are living very conscious existences, making really important choices, caring about their environment, caring about animal rights and human rights and the clothes they wear and what they buy, not buying stuff they don't need. So that's good. We have a basis from which to work collectively to make change. But we have to be aware of how big the problem is. And here is the problem. When I'm out filming, I don't see anyone from the networks where I film. I don't see any politicians where I film. I don't see any of the demagogues like Bill O'Reilly, or Sean Hannity, or Rush Limbaugh, Rachel Maddow, Keith Olbermann. Oh, Keith, you're a work. You know, do you think for a moment, Keith, that screaming, ranting, demeaning is going to convince people? It's the facts you share that ultimately convince. And if you don't have facts on your side, then I guess you got to scream. We're going to hear Keith screaming in a moment. But I'm concerned about North America. I'm concerned about the wildfires. Do you remember all the wildfires that just ravaged Tennessee, took out a whole town in North Carolina, South Carolina, in Western Texas, all across America, 36,000 major wildfires. And this is outside of the fire season. And what about that flooding in Louisiana? We're in one single parish. Remember, Louisiana is made up of parishes. We call them counties here. They had 68,000 damaged homes, some so severely people will never be able to move back in there, and none of them had flood insurance because they weren't in a floodplain. It was a once-in-a-500-year episode, but now we've had seven of these once-in-a-500-year episode. Oh, by the way, the Tennessee fires make it eight different major events that were only supposed to happen every 500 years. Well, eight just happened in the last year. So the environment is exploding. But if you don't live there, if you haven't experienced it firsthand, if you haven't turned on a faucet and seen either no water come out or turgid, dark water filled with chemicals, then you won't appreciate the message. Unless you have been in a hurricane, a typhoon, an earthquake, a tornado, a wildfire, severe torrential rain, 10 inches in 10 hours, never before in American history, but that happened 3 times this year in Texas, then you won't appreciate it. If you're living in a building where nothing's touching you today, then surely it won't tomorrow. But it will. This is from Dar Jamal. He says, while President Obama remained clearly in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry with his unwillingness to take the radical actions necessary to mitigate the already dire impacts of global warming, he was at least willing to admit that we live in a crisis never before seen. Now, why is that important? Because Donald Trump and his entire administration refused to even acknowledge that. I constantly hear people talking about, we've got to undermine Trump. No, you don't. Step back, friend. Take an honest look. This man will destroy himself, and the people he selected are guaranteed. Why? Because every one of the picks he has made fortunes exploiting people. Home foreclosure, that's one of the kings, the person who made billions foreclosing on people. Now he's supposed to turn around, all these people are supposed to turn around and disconnect from that toxic legacy and make money for the very people that they had been taking money and resources from. That's not going to happen. They will all use this as an opportunity to exploit the power they've been given. There'll be major scandals, one after the other. And this person will have no credibility. And then you'll see a phenomena. If Donald Trump does not, in a very specific way, bring millions of new jobs and quality of life to the people who trusted and voted for him, then they will see that they turn against him. And you have no idea the power that'll be unleashed when you have 64 million people who trusted you completely, and you betrayed them, and you put it all into the hands of people that despise the very electorate, and they will throw Trump out of office. The media, those of us who are journalists, we will continue to report and bring you the scandal after scandal. But I think time and effort means we should be putting energy into saving our environment, protecting society from itself, bringing to attention what we can do that's constructive and positive. If you only have so many hours in a day, why would you put it all day angry at someone and blaming them instead of constructively doing something to show that we can come up with solutions? For example, what would be your solution if you go into Katanning, Pennsylvania, a small Polish mining town that's suffering from dire poverty, and bring hope and jobs to them? What would you do? Be specific. Give me specific answers. Don't have any? Well, we need answers. What would we do to deghettoize America? I have a lot of ideas. I've shared them constantly. I've even been willing to, out of my own pocket, to take over an entire reconstruction of a block in the worst city in America. You give me the worst city, the worst ghetto, the worst neighborhood, give me the worst block in America, and watch within 6 months it becomes a vital, thriving, wonderful community again, with the people from the community contributing and benefiting, and that becomes a model you can use anywhere. You see, blaming and being negative doesn't solve any problem. Could you imagine coming into my life and say, Gary, I got a stage 4 cancer, I had all the therapies, I had them again, and now they say there's nothing more they can do, so they want me to go to hospice care and put my life in order. By the way, I've heard this story thousands of times, real story. And what are you going to do? And I go, what if I said, oh, God, you're dying? Wow, that's a bummer. Ooh, you got to think about being dead and all your friends coming, looking at you in the coffin or being cremated. That's kind of yucky. And it's going to cost. Who's going to pay for that? And think of all the people you're leaving behind. Man, how are you going to deal with the pain? You going to take some morphine? Yeah, no. I don't have that conversation, ever. But I know a lot of people sitting on local station boards, that's the only conversation they know. Death, destruction, denialism, pointing fingers, and blaming. And I got to ask you, friend, when was the last time you actually created something that was sustainable, that helped everyone without a consideration of what your politic, what your race, what your age, what your income or class status? Just help people because it's the right thing to do. You not only feel good about doing it, but it actually can change some of those bitter, sour dispositions. Though if you take that on as your moniker, then every day, no matter how bright the sun is, you've got to find a reason to blame. That's what we see. So right now, we need all of the energies we have put forth to creating solutions instead of assigning blame. That's my point of view. It's mine alone. People can agree or disagree with it. So when we look at the wildfires and we're looking at the hottest days on record, and we look at the worst rain, and we look at the earth and how it is being destroyed, and there's no stopping the construction companies, there's no stopping the developers, there's no stopping local governments that want the income that comes from the tax base, there's no stopping exploitation of even overused, depleted, where people have no water and they're moving there. There's no changing dumb. It's not unintentional ignorance, it's intentional. What you don't want to change, you simply will refuse to accept information. So we need to become aware that the environment is really devastating. In, for example, right now, as I speak, in Africa, there are 33 million Africans who cannot feed themselves, and there's no food for them, or they have no water. Now, they haven't gotten to Europe with the other 6 to 7 million that got there as refugees, because it wasn't because of civil war, like in Libya or in Syria or the other countries. It's because they're poor. They can't make that trek. They're landlocked, and they're dying. But it's not our backyard. We don't see them. So what's going to happen when it's 200 million people who cannot survive? Imagine that crisis. Are we prepared for that? Is anyone prepared for it? Are we doing anything about it? In Pakistan? In India? By the way, stop believing that India is a thriving economy. India is a basket case of rabid institutional racism, corruption at every level, and poverty unimaginable. Just imagine this, 750 million plus Indians live in dire, abject poverty, don't even have a toilet, have to go outside each day. They don't have clean drinking water. They don't have adequate food. And what's being done by the Indian government? How about nothing? One of the worst governments in history is the government in India, previous and current. But we like to believe that, oh, it's great for businesses. Yeah, businesses that can exploit it, but not for the people who live there. So what about the 260 million Americans who are living just above, at, or below the poverty level? What happens to the 2.4 million children who are homeless, go to school but have no home to go to? What happens to all these people when you cut back their benefits even more, and then the price of food goes up because of drought, because we no longer can put water to irrigate food fields, or we've created dust bowls? Then you're going to see an awful lot of hungry Americans, and you're going to have a return to the migration of the 1920s and 30s, but there's a big difference. These people are going to be extremely angry. So keep in mind, what we do not deal with is going to meet us at some point. I'm saying, find what you can do. You can go meatless. You can stop buying anything from box stores. You can look at the label of every single thing you purchase, and if it's made by exploited labor, don't buy it. Start to be considerate about helping your neighbor. 28 million Americans living in 7 million homes had their homes foreclosed on. There was no movement to protect those homeowners. People looked out the window blinds to the neighbor who's being escorted off the property by the marshals. What have we become? We've detached ourselves, and the younger generation in particular. We need to reattach. To the environment, we can do a lot. We can do a lot because we have the information. We can have community groups that show in local schools, community halls, documentaries, which there are many, on the environment, give out articles, post articles on the internet, get them into school. Teachers are willing to read about the environment to their students, let them know about water and why we shouldn't be buying any water that comes from Nestle's or corporate America, why we have to know how healthy the water is coming out of our tap. These are simple things to do, but at least they're a step in the right direction. We can start to encourage people to understand the dangers of the American diet. If every American had programs in school that taught kids how to garden, where food comes from, you would have the vast majority wanting to become vegan when they saw the slaughter and torture of factory farms and animals. And then the health of doing something as they do in Japan. Oh, by the way, in Japan, every single day when you go to school, the students make the meals. They cook. They clean every single thing in the school. They have to clean down and sanitize their desks. They mop the floors. They mop the steps. They mop the bathrooms, clean the toilets. The students do this. They have respect for the teacher. They learn about life. They have gardening classes. They learn about nature. Why can't American kids in schools learn some of these lessons? Just some thoughts. I'm going to save for a little later my new information from one of the top U.S. spy agencies did not embrace the CIA assessment on Russia, hacking sources, and how I have a list that I will read of some of the top whistleblowers in American history who are all saying that the leaks were not hacks. The leak had to have originated inside the Clinton and Democratic Party and was given to Julian Assange. A hack is different than a leak. A leak comes from an individual working there who's able with a thumb drive to take information off a computer that they believe is wrong, illegal, unethical, immoral. And since that they have information that is damning, they give it to an outside source like a Julian Assange. And then he reports it and gives it to the media. The media's attacking this as if it were Russia. Russia had nothing to do with this. Nothing. There's no proof at all. But you would know that by listening to Keith Overman. I want you to hear this because I just want you to see how so many people on the left deal with the truth in very inappropriate manners.
There's big news that you, dear Americans, have completely missed. Your country is at war, which it has already lost.
We are at war with Russia. Or perhaps more correctly, we have lost a war with Russia without a battle. We are no longer a sovereign nation. We are no longer a democracy. We are no longer a free people. The nation and all of our freedoms hang by a thread, and the military apparatus of this country is about to be handed over to scum who are beholden to scum, Russian scum.
One has to wonder how thick the walls of the basement where the GQ special correspondent sits are, or how long will this spiraling downfall of sanity in the mainstream media continue. But believe it or not, even in this incredible 7-minute rant where comparisons between Pearl Harbor and the Russian alleged hacking were made, there was still 20 seconds of common sense.
Barack Obama has twice stood in front of America, in front of the world, in front of history, and said, I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Today is the time for him to do so. He must immediately declassify and release all relevant materials held by the FBI, the CIA, DHS, and the other intelligence and security services.
Wouldn't that be a right thing to do, especially since the accusations are so severe, especially in the country where presumption of innocence, not guilty until proven otherwise, is supposed to be among the main ideals? Well, many, ourselves included, have been demanding for months that any evidence should be released. To date, there has been none. And now journalist Jeremy Scahill, writing for The Intercept, argues that the U.S. president simply must do that, and that would be the only way forward. Taking Donald Trump's position, he writes, just we should ignore the question of Russian hacking and move on, would be a disaster. Relying on a hazy war of leaks from the CIA, FBI, various politicians, and their staff is an equally terrible idea. A congressional investigation, he says, would be somewhat better, but that would take years, like the investigations of WMDs in Iraq, and would be fatally compromised compromised by the Democrats' political timidity and GOP opposition. The only path forward, Cahill concludes, is to make sense for Obama to order the release of as much evidence as possible underlying the reported high confidence of U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia both intervened in the election and did so with the intention of aiding Trump's candidacy. Cahill's point is solidified by how long this frenzy has been going on. The first reports of Russia's alleged hacks came in June 14th, just in time for the DNC convention, which eventually landed Hillary Clinton her presidential nomination. The next time it made a lot of waves in the country was on October 7th, a joint statement by the U.S. intelligence formally accusing Russia of the hack. The timing of that, just a month before the general election, and also when the WikiLeaks revelations were already delivering a crushing blow on Clinton's campaign. And finally, December 9th, anonymous leaks from CIA sources. Again, 10 days before the college vote. Again, all this timing might certainly be coincidental, but until the public sees forensic evidence, if such exists at all, these accusations should carry as much weight as online humor and suggestions that America is at war.
Alexei Roshevsky. Well, at least we know with Keith. Keith, I bet you didn't have enough fiber today. You've got a really badass attitude that screaming is no replacement for facts. And that's so common in that whole milieu that he functions in. Tomorrow, we'll give you facts, documented details of all of America and the CIA's false flags, Hillary Clinton's false flags, Obama's false flags, actual events, dates, times, proof. And I'm going to go back not that far, but I'll show you how I would trust nothing coming out of the White House, nothing coming out of the CIA. And we sure don't trust this because there's no proof. If there were, they had arrested that person in a heartbeat. But you're going to hear from Mr. Binney and a whole lot of other whistleblowers on tomorrow's program. Plus, you think that Hillary Clinton lost because of these hacked emails? Well, tomorrow I'm going to do an in-depth commentary on the hawk in the Middle East, how Hillary Clinton was the most hawkish Secretary of State in American history, and even more hawkish than the Defense Department head, and she got her way. So is it possible that her actions, her history, and reputation are what caused people not to vote for her? That's tomorrow. I'll be doing two programs. One with our Greek guests for the whole hour on our sister station, BAI, and other stations, and a different commentary that I'll be doing for an hour on Progressive Radio Network. And now to close out our program today, one of the most brilliant, insightful, and prophetic journalists on the planet, John Pilger. Please listen in.
In the months leading up to the presidential election, the corporate media worked in hyperdrive to sell Hillary Clinton to America.
Party loyalists on both sides became frantic that the candidate they helped create could take the empire's throne, with unpredictable consequences. Amidst a curtain of unquestioning and sycophantic media coverage, a bombshell was dropped by WikiLeaks just weeks before the election, exposing the inner workings of the Clinton clique. An ongoing series of thousands of emails from John Podesta, the chairman of Hillary's presidential campaign.
While John Podesta is treated as just a well-meaning Clinton supporter who had his privacy unjustly exposed, he's actually one of the most powerful people in Washington, operating mostly behind the scenes, until now.
John and his brother Tony are considered two of the most influential corporate lobbyists in the world. John has been dubbed one of Washington's biggest players by the New York Times, whose clients are going to get a blueprint for how to succeed in official Washington. And he's much more than just a millionaire lobbyist. He's also been the man behind Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. The Washington Post praised his political experience, saying no single person may be more responsible for shaping the ambitions of Obama's second term than he.
But we should pay no attention to what the emails of one of the most powerful men in the world say. Instead, we should talk about Russia.
Well, Chris, I think we should take a step back and say how we got here, which is that the Russians, as the U.S. senior members of the U.S. government confirmed, have been hacking into Democratic accounts, and now they've hacked into my account.
You are very clearly quoting from WikiLeaks, and what's really important about WikiLeaks is that the Russian government has engaged in espionage against Americans.
George, when you see something postmarked from Russia, you should be afraid to open up the documents.
These are legit, aren't they?
When you see, I don't know. I refuse to open these documents.
It was the big money from a foreign person to the foundation at the time she's running for president.
This was, as you can see in those emails, this was a scheduling matter, and we didn't want her going overseas. I didn't want her going overseas before the campaign was kicking off. But again, these are stolen documents, stolen by the Russians. It's now confirmed from John Podesta. They are being put out for exactly this purpose.
You know, I know that Russia and other forces would love us to have a debate. This is exactly what they want. They want us to have a debate about the internal structure of Hillary's campaign, what's true, what's not true, and I'm just not going to play that.
As president, I will make it clear that the United States will treat cyber attacks just like any other attack. We will be ready with serious political, economic, and military responses.
Just one problem. The evidence they're pointing to proving Putin was behind the emails is not evidence at all. Only two intelligence agencies, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Department of Homeland Security, have issued a joint statement used by the Clinton campaign as so-called proof. Yet it's purely speculative, saying the alleged hacks are consistent with the methods and motivations of Russian-directed efforts. These thefts and disclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. Such activity is not new to Moscow. Consistent with the methods? So not really proof at all. The FBI also resisted getting behind the accusation on the basis that the claim was inconclusive. But the media simply repeats the claim as gospel, while never mentioning the other logical ways Podesta's emails could have gotten out. For example, his username was his own name, and his password was literally password. In 2015, he left his cell phone in a cab. And in March 2016, Podesta gave his email login to hackers after falling for a phishing scam appearing to come from Google, where he typed in his info. Not to mention the thousands of skilled hackers who are not part of a Russian government operation, or a disgruntled insider who could have leaked the emails.
When you look into the Podesta emails, the breadth of what they show explains why they're running such a desperate deflection campaign.
Part of the WikiLeaks trove are transcripts to Hillary's infamous speeches she gave to banks and other corporations, for which she earned millions of dollars. In one, she assures her corporate sponsors that what she's saying to voters isn't her true position. Politics is like sausage being made. It is unsavory, and it's always been that way. But we usually end up where we need to be. But if everybody's watching, you know, all the backroom discussions and deals, then people get a little nervous, to say the least. So, you need both a public and a private position. And the way she discusses accountability for Wall Street, her number one donor, is very different behind closed doors. In one speech to Goldman Sachs, she criticized the fact that the banks were made into the bad guys for their financial collapse. And she thinks the very banks who rigged and crashed the economy are those who should be in charge of it. I think that there's a lot that could have been avoided in terms of both misunderstanding and really politicizing what happened with greater transparency. You guys help us figure it out, and let's make sure we do it right this time. The people that know the industry better than anybody are the people who work in the industry. Another major find they'd like to keep hidden is the unlawful coordination between Hillary's super PAC, Correct the Record, and her presidential campaign. A caveat of the devastating Citizens United ruling is that super PACs and nonprofits must remain independent of campaigns. Yet emails prove that Correct the Record is just another multi-million dollar arm of the Clinton campaign, making contributions between the super PAC and campaign indistinguishable. This short sampling of the Podesta email trove is alone a major expose of the true character of Hillary Clinton. But beyond that, understanding who John Podesta is and his political rise sheds light on who really pulls the levers of power in our society. John and his brother-slash-lobbying partner Tony have been rooted since childhood in the most elite circles of American politics. Their mother, Mary Podesta, was a well-known fundraiser at the center of the political scene. The Washington Post described her as a staple at political dinners, whose home-cooked dinner parties, quote, raised millions of dollars for candidates. The Podesta brothers would employ the same network-building style, with personas that reflect their high society characteristics. They're also both known for their fine dining culinary skills and deal-making dinner parties. Both are collectors of fine art, and are even known to have a competition between them of who has the better collection. You know, like most Americans do. Through the 70s, the young Podestas began building their political web. John first befriended Bill Clinton as an undergrad in college. Both brothers worked for Democratic Party campaigns in their younger years. With their growing political connections, also came business connections. Having accumulated a wide network of business and political insights.
Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. And don't forget, this coming Monday, I'm going to do a presentation of a new documentary that you haven't seen on overcoming depression and anxiety. Then I'm going to do a webinar on loneliness. Please go to prn.fm or progressiveradionetwork.com and take a look. Sign up. Have a nice day.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you.